Another endearingly shambolic podcast from WeDigPodcasts.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on WeDigPodcasts.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking. On with the podcast.
Welcome to this fortnight's edition of We Dig Music. With me, as always, are my comrades and co-hosts, Trollin.
Which one of us is that?
And Casey. Just both of you say hello.
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 There we go.
And who are you?
I'm Ian.
Yeah. So it's rubbish when people forget to say their own name, isn't it?
Terrible,
Tracy?
Isn't it?
Yes. So,
I forget everything.
Shut up. This week, we're talking about the letter K.
We are.
Cool and the Gang.
I think I'd prefer that.
Cataclysm.
Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Casey and the Sunshine Band, for sure.
KT Tunstall.
Oh, Tracy's favourites.
What we're actually doing, though, not talking about fucking turncoats. We're talking about Fela Kuti.
We are.
And Kings of Leon.
Boom.
Tracy.
No.
No.
Ask Colin to tell us about Fela Kuti.
Colin.
Go on then.
Tell us something about Fela Kuti.
Just one thing.
One.
I shall tell you many. Olufella Olusegun Oludotun Ransom Kuti, later known as Fela Kuti, was a Nigerian Afrobeat pioneer who's a multi-instrumentalist, musician, composer, pioneer and human rights activist. It says on here on Wikipedia, he has been called superstar, singer, musician, pan-Africanist, polygamist, mystic legend.
Wow.
He is basically, he's Africa's Elvis Presley, basically.
Was Elvis a polygamist?
I don't know.
I suspect he wasn't.
He was not famous at any point for marrying, like, 37 of his wives all on stage in one ceremony, which
no.
Fela did. So, it's a lot different. Fela's music is a lot different to a lot of the stuff that we've done previously.
Yes.
Very.
So it's going to...
Apart from Yaesu, this is definitely the longest average song length.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, longest average, yes.
Oh, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
But none of them are infinity length.
I think he's done some that are live.
Yeah.
They were longer.
Wow.
Quite often live, he would...
This is, of course, Infinity by Yaesu, not Infinity, yeah. The actual thing.
No. Yeah, he's not still playing now.
Because he's dead.
Because, unfortunately, he died in 1997. But, yeah, he was... So, to give a bit of context on what Afrobeat is, it's music... There was a style of music in Ghana called High Life.
Right.
Which was African pop music, basically.
Yeah,
But it was. There's elements of sort of calypso in there. There's a lot of quite clean, quite intricate polyrhythmic guitars. It's really upbeat, and it's basically sort of their dance. You know, I take the thing that most people will have the sort of concept of, the kind of guitar melodies that Paul Simon was doing on Graceland when he was working with loads of African musicians, that's all from the Afrobeat kind of style. So that's what a lot of Western
also like
audiences
the,
would know.
I've forgotten the name of the band. The Last Paramore album, actually.
Yes,
really?
There are.
Yes.
Yeah, Talking Heads. Yeah.
Yes.
Which the Paramore album was influenced by.
Well, obviously.
Yeah. So there's a load of like Afrobeat and fella influence in that kind of thing. So Fela Kuti was basically the pioneer of Afrobeat, where he took the sort of high life kind of thing and he mixed it with basically funk, soul and jazz influences. There's loads of like James Brown groove type stuff in there.
Yes.
But then they built on, because they'd got their own sort of African musicians who hadn't been raised on Western music at all.
Yeah.
Completely took it in a different direction because it was their own interpretation of that kind of style.
Mm.
So
there's a lot of jazz in there as well,
there's
though.
Loads of jazz.
I mean, he's a big John Coltrane fan.
Yeah. Well, so Fela Kuti, his musical career started out in the late 50s. He was sent to... So, to give a bit of background, his parents were quite well-known people in Africa.
Right. The Kutis.
The Ransom Kutis. His mother was Chief Funmiloyo Ransom Kuti. She was a teacher, political campaigner and women's rights activist. She was the first woman in Nigeria to drive a car.
Wow.
She was one of the main people that brought about getting women the vote in Nigeria. She used to travel all over the world and she met people like Chairman Mao and people like that to like build on her like political activism.
Wow.
She was known as the Mother of Africa or the Lioness of Lusabi. And
the second one is a much cooler name than the Mother of Africa.
And his dad was a minister, teacher and a trade union leader.
Yeah.
So they're quite political, but they were still quite... African society then was quite sort of strict.
Yeah.
And he described it as it being quite conservative.
Hmm.
In 1958, they sent him to England to go to university to train as a doctor.
Yeah.
So he got to England and changed his mind and enrolled in a music course.
Of course,
At which point he started getting into jazz.
Well, that was a classical music course he enrolled on.
It was like composition. Yeah. In 1958, I don't think they would have had any music courses other than classical.
No, I guess not.
But he chose that so that he could learn sort of compositional styles and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Mm. So he studied music, formed this band called Kula Lobitos, which he played around London for a bit. At that time, he met Ginger Baker. It was later the drummer in Cream.
Yeah, yeah.
Who he worked with a fair bit. Like, there's a live album with Ginger Baker that is fantastic.
I saw the cover to that.
He didn't listen to it. So he went back to Nigeria. Kula Lobitos was playing sort of a hybrid of high life and jazz. So it was quite short songs.
And apparently there was quite an underground London craze for African dance music at that time as well in the early 60s. So
I think you'd got a lot of the black community sort of started building up around that time with all the people brought over from like the Windrush and stuff, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, admittedly a lot of those were Caribbean, but they're families originally are going to be from Africa.
Yeah.
So there's definitely going to be a lot of that, and then that's going to cross-pollinate with the people they met around London and the rest of the country. So Fela went back to Africa, reformed Kula Lobitos with African musicians. He went to Ghana for a little bit to jam with, because Ghana's where High Life was from.
Yeah.
Mm. So he jammed with them a bit to think up a new musical direction, where he'd been listening to a lot of like funk and soul and jazz, so he brought that in and called it Afrobeat.
Yeah.
And then in 1969, he went to LA. Ooh. And spent went to America, spent 10 months in LA. He met a girl who he started going out with,
yeah,
who was part of the Black Panthers.
Ooh. Sandra Isidore.
That's her. So he renamed his band Nigeria 70 and started gigging around the LA area, and they were tipped off. Basically, immigration got tipped off by a promoter.
Yeah,
that they were over there illegally because I think the visas had run out.
Yeah, yeah.
So they really quickly, immediately went into a studio and recorded an album that's the 69 LA Sessions is what it's called, and then got out of there before they got deported. went back to Nigeria.
Yeah.
Where they formed, he bought a commune for him and his band to live in.
Right.
And there was a nightclub next door, or just across the street, that he bought, that at that point they called the Afro Spot. And he just started doing these shows there.
Yeah.
And people started coming from all around Africa. We'll come back to sort of the chronology of this. Is going to be a bit more structured than some of the other episodes we've done because there's so much history involved in what happened.
Yeah.
But how I got into this kind of thing is through my dad. My dad's a big fan of African music. There's a band called Ossibisa, who were formed in London, but they're all African musicians playing sort of Afrobeat type stuff, formed in about 1970, so they'd obviously have an influence from Fela Kuti.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's from that I got into things like Kandabongo Man and the Bundu Boys, who John Peel was a massive fan of.
Yeah.
And then there's a guy called Thomas Mapfumo, who's known as the Lion of Zimbabwe.
That is a cool name.
It is a cool name.
Andy Kershaw was massive.
Andy Kershaw and Peel were basically the sort of UK champions for this throughout the 80s, definitely.
Yeah.
It was really fashionable because that's like when WOMAD started and things like that.
Yeah.
I hate the term world music.
Do you?
It's a fucking lazy term because if you go.
Yeah, because it's not particularly world, is it? It's just like. Mostly African.
No, not necessarily. You go into a... It doesn't describe the music at all.
Not really.
Because if you go into a record shop and look in the world music bit, you'll have, like, Brazilian music in there.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have Afrobeat. You'll have, Indian sitar music. None of these styles of music have anything in common at all.
But then again, they do that with world cinema as well, don't they?
Yeah, but they're basically going...
Films that are not from
it's
America...
Not white.
Not from the UK.
Yeah. He's not white boys with guitars or synthesizers.
We don't know what the proper genre is. We don't know where to file it.
We'll just pile it over here.
Yeah.
But that was, nevertheless, world music is what, there was a massive craze on it in the 80s.
Yeah.
So you've got Peter Gabriel started the WOMAD Festival.
Did he start that? I didn't know
Yeah,
that.
Peter Gabriel started WOMAD.
Okay.
Or he was very heavily involved with it. I think he started it.
Right.
Because he runs Real World Records.
Have you been?
No.
No, nor me. No. I was supposed to 1 year and didn't for some reason.
I've always liked the look of it.
Yeah.
But he's got Real World Records is his record label as well, which is you have loads of people on there like Afro Celt Sound System, drummers of Burundi and stuff like that, all releasing stuff on there. But yeah, I've got a mate at work, a guy called Olu, who is Nigerian.
Yeah.
So I was talking to him about it the other day. Because I don't know many people that... Fella's a bit of a niche kind of thing over here. There's not that many people that particularly talk about it. He gets mentioned as being influential by quite a lot of musicians because of the grooves. But you don't often meet other people who... are into Afrobeat and Fela Kuti and that kind of thing. So I mentioned it to Olu at work the other day. I was like, of course I know Fela, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Because to people growing up in Nigeria, he is like, he's their punk rock, he's their Elvis Presley, he's not only a musician, he's a fucking folk hero.
Yeah.
There's you know, there's stories about him, like legends that are almost like Robin Hood sort of legends and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, he later declared his commune an independent... He declared it a breakaway state in 1974.
Yes, he did. Well, there's loads of stuff that he did that sort of politically motivated like that. But the kind of legends that they've got stories about apparently at one point... Cause he was essentially at war with the government.
Yeah. He was arrested over 200 times in his lifetime.
Yes. Arrested and beaten.
Yeah.
And survived through most of it.
Unlike his mother.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely get into that in a bit. We've got a lot to talk about.
We do.
So, he... one of the stories that Olu told me about the other day was obviously because he's under threat of attack the whole time and he's quite into sort of mysticism and he shows at the Afro Spot and later the Calicut Republic the Shrine was the club were sort of part gigs and part rituals because he was really into the Yoruba people, which is the sort of people that he comes from in Nigeria. Their sort of religion is sort of part Christianity, but then there's a lot of like sort of voodoo kind of stuff in there as well.
Cool.
So at one point he was there were these people that came to see him with this coat where he told him, you know, if you get shot, this is like mystical coat that will save you and, you know, you'll be immortal while you're wearing it. So, and they put it on this goat and shot the goat.
Yeah.
And the goat survived. And fella's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get that. That's brilliant. And then one of his friends was like, hold on, fella, think about this. Let's use one of our guns. Shot the goat. Its head exploded. Completely killed this fucking goat.
Yeah.
At which point they went, yeah, I think they might have been trying to rip me off there. And that is a legend that they're told as kids. According to Olu, he was told this by his family growing up. And then I read about it in like articles later on with interviews with him and stuff like that.
So it's kind of almost like a folk hero.
Exactly.
He's blending into myths almost, yeah. Like urban myths.
Yeah.
Wow.
He was going back to the at war with the government. Nigeria had this really oppressive military government. And they were the leader was a guy called Olusegun Obasanjo. He was corrupt as fuck. He was the head of state. He later became the president in the 90s after fella died. Fella used to basically taunt this guy. In the early 70s, he changed the name of the Afro Spot to the Shrine. He purchased his own printing press, and they used to print a paper that he got this like youth group that he was sort of teaching politics to and music and that kind of thing. And these kids used to go around and distribute these like basically propaganda papers around. They were called the Young African Pioneers. At this time, he developed a seriously strong strain of marijuana, which he called Goro, which he managed to get the Nigerian embassy to list as medicine so that he could take it across like borders when he went on tour and things like
Fantastic.
That.
Fantastic.
So he was really, really politicised at this point. Changed his name from Ransom Kuti to Anakalupo, which means so his fella Anakalupo Kuti, which means he who carries death in his pouch.
Okay.
he was basically angering the government at pretty much every turn. And April 74 was the first government raid on his commune. So he was arrested for possession.
Yeah.
And he was released on bail, and then immediately renamed the commune the Calicut Republic, and declared it a republic.
Calicutta was the name of the prison cell he'd been held in, apparently.
Ah, I hadn't read that. Mm-hmm. That's cool. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So he declared the commune as the Calicutta Republic, and they had their own passports, which is
weird. Because
you aren't going to be talking about something else later on.
The place had its own laws and its own prison, and he was just like judge, jury, and jailer in this state.
Yeah, whilst I don't think also, it went as far as executioner.
Well, no, but I mean, you know, but while also religiously rehearsing his music every day as well.
But it's they used to get more and more raids on the commune. November 1974, the third raid in a year. Way more violent than all the others. He was hospitalised for 9 days.
Shit.
And as a result of that, he released. There was a few albums that he released. It was Calicutta Show, and various other ones. But then this next one, Expensive Shit, was a record he released, which was based on a raid. There was a police raid where they tried to plant weed on him.
Yeah.
So he asked to see the evidence, swallowed it in front of them, at which point they arrested him, and the prosecutors demanded that he produced his shit so that they could use it. So what he managed to do was secretly shit it out and then buy one of the other prisoners' feces, which he then passed to them, and they had to let him go because there was no marijuana in it.
Oh, man.
Wow.
And obviously this Goro that he was smoking before meant that he had a massive fucking tolerance, so that he was able to do that after eating this evidence that they'd given him. But yeah, so he released a record called Zombie, which is absolutely fucking perfect. It's one of my favourite songs ever. It's got such a fucking good groove, but it's all about how the soldier from the government are just following orders and, you know, not thinking for themselves.
Oh, is that what it's about?
Yes.
See, I was just mad at that song because it made me burn my fucking food.
So he's questioning soldiers' blind obedience, but he's also urging the masses to rise up against them, which started really riling them.
Yeah, they weren't too happy.
So no one's questioned that, then? No one's questioned why I burnt my food.
No, I think because Tracy was interrupting
it. It sounds like he's singing Sunbeam for half the song, though.
He's only singing for like half the fucking song.
He does, yeah, the vocals don't come in till late. So, Ian, how did it make you burn your fish fingers?
Well, it didn't make me burn. I wasn't cooking fish fingers.
Oh, okay.
I was cooking something more healthy.
I thought you said fish fingers.
No,
okay,
it's like some pasta and stuff like that. Okay. But, like, I was just kind of half measuring it on the length of songs. It's on the playlist, you know, and that was.
He actually has this
pasta
thing
on, and then I will. In about one song's time, it'll be ready.
That's the thing, yeah, because nothing really changes in the song for quite a while, so it's really hard to keep a grasp on how long things have happened. And then I looked at the time and I was like, motherfucker, this thing is like 20 minutes long.
It's 12 minutes something.
It's about 13. Vocals start at 5.5.
But yeah, that was too long for my pasta.
It took me until 8 minutes to actually start getting into the groove. I mean, 30 seconds in, noodling jazz saxophone.
There is a lot of saxophones, which I know you're not going to
like. A lot of saxophone.
Saxophones are great.
But I was just thinking. But I was just thinking. Still, at least it's not the cranberries.
What?
That is, because of Zombie. Yeah.
Ah,
yeah.
So that's a fucking weird leap there.
The main problem here, Tracy, is you fear jazz. You fear its lack of rules.
Well, I went to a gig last week, and a support band were called Near Jazz Experience.
That's a shit name.
Actually. No, they were really good. And at one point he's playing not one saxophone, but two simultaneously.
Excellent. That's impressive.
And while I was listening to Fela Kuti in the playlist, I was actually thinking, I wonder if it would be different if I saw this live. Would I find it as tedious? and I think the answer is no, because when I watched Near Jazz Experience and I was watching him play sax, I had what I'm now terming a sax-pifany.
That sounds really bad.
and then also he handed out a whole bunch of shaky eggs to about 20 people at the front of the crowd, so we were
You do love a shaky egg.
I do love a shaky egg. Me and Kirsty. And And so half of the crowd were part of the percussion, and that made a big difference. And so if you're there...
participating.
And it made sense. Actually, all of a sudden, made sense. So I had a near jazz experience. See,
whereas I have always been like, yeah, jazz, you know, it's the smuggest of music. But like, we went to jazz brunch at the Thousand Trades, just up there. Amazing food, by the way.
I've heard good things.
And we stuck around because they had a jazz jam night thing. And it was filled with musos, students from the conservatoire and stuff like that.
Right.
And I realised that I don't fucking understand jazz at all, right? Because this saxophonist would start playing stuff, and it would be like, okay, yeah, the phrasing was all right, it was okay, it was interesting. And everyone would just lose their shit and start clapping. It's like, what? That was three fucking notes. It was all right, the timing was okay, but fuck, man, I'm not blown away by this musicianship at all. Why are you all fucking clapping? I don't get this. Like, I would have only been more taken aback if they'd done that fucking clicking bullshit. Although, to be honest, if they'd done that, I'd have just gone.
There's a lot of different types of jazz, though.
That was...
You like... There's definitely some jazz that you like. You love the soundtracks on the Fallout games.
No, but the thing is, I do like jazz in general.
Yeah.
Like, I say the smuggest, but I don't mean that as an insult. Yeah. I just didn't understand the fans. Like, I could have listened to it all night quite happily, because, you know, it was nice.
It's nice.
It was backgroundy, like, but, like, they were clapping like it was fucking earth-shattering, you know? You know, like, the first time people saw Eddie Van Halen, they were like, motherfucker, how the hell is he doing that? Like, they were clapping like people who'd just seen two-handed tapping for the first time. Like, musicians who were just like, this has blown my fucking head open, I don't understand this.
Perhaps it was their first time hearing jazz.
It 100% was not, because no, they'd all got instruments and they were all waiting to take their turns. So I guess maybe they were just building a thing so that next time they went up and went, people would be like, oh my god, that was amazing.
Unless it was that it was in joke, it may be that they just played The Lick. If you have a look on YouTube for The Lick, it is, there's a phrase in jazz. It's occasionally appears in other music as well, but it's just this like 5-note phrase that loads of people use, and it almost gets used like an in joke now. And it's
like a meme.
It's like the Wilhelm scream in movies.
Yeah.
Which is one that sound engineers put in to move. It started off with... it's in all of the Star Wars films and Indiana Jones and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And once you hear it, once you know what it is, you can't not hear it when you watch things. And it could well be that was a similar thing, perhaps.
Maybe.
It could be that he just played something ridiculously technical.
It was not that.
No.
I can recognise ridiculous technical playing. Like, that bit where I went, beep boop, was basically what was happening. Right?
Amazing.
I listened to a lot of this playlist while I was killing time in Tamworth Town Centre. And the bells were being played at St Editha's Church. And so while I was listening to Teacher Don't Teach Me No Nonsense, a 25-minute long track, the bells were playing over the top of it for a lot. And actually, almost worked.
Okay, they're in the right key then.
Yeah, and when they were in time, it was like, oh, this is all right.
Fair enough. So, Zombie.
Zombie. Sorry, we were getting to an important bit.
Yes,
Colin's pulling a Tracy.
I am.
We've just both digressed, and Colin's like, right, back on fucking track.
You have to with this one.
Sorry, I just got to say this.
Yeah.
My girlfriend Lydia's friend Lucy has been listening to the podcast because she's been off work and stuff, and she has got names for us now. You are the musical encyclopedia. You, Tracy, are the journalist.
Okay.
And I am the raconteur, because I just fucking tell these stupid ass stories, and you know everything, and Tracy has researched everything
and rattle my notes.
Yes.
So
I felt that was very accurate.
Yeah, no, I can't argue with that.
Do you know what? You're trying to get like back to this, though, right, kind of the way that Fela Kuti, apparently, he's an absolute drill master for rehearsing his band.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he's like James Brown.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of parallels with James Brown.
Right, Back on it. February 1977.
Hold on, because you've just reminded me of a tangent that I wanted to go on.
Oh, okay.
But it is Fela Kuti related. James Brown and his entourage and band visited the shrine in the early 1970s.
Yeah.
And apparently, according to Tony Allen, is Fela Kuti's drummer, who was his drummer pretty much the whole way through.
Yeah.
Tony Allen claims that James Brown had some of his people sitting by his drum kit trying to chart out his drum patterns while he was playing so that they could then bring it back and rip it off.
God, they'd have had a job. I mean, the syncopation involved in it's amazing.
Tony Allen is
it's
tremendous.
Mad.
Absolutely amazing. But yeah, so, okay, Zombie angered the authorities so much. Fela had also claimed that if there was a fair election, then he would be the president because he was so popular in
right.
Nigeria at that point. So I think the government saw it as a real threat that he was potentially going to get all these people to rise up. So February 18th, 1977, 1,000 soldiers stormed the Calicut Republic.
Wow.
It was a 15-hour siege where they were like firing mortars. They've got their own generator, so the army blew up the generator, which started a fire. Fela's mother, who was 76 years old at this point, was thrown from the second floor window by one of these soldiers. She was in a coma for about 3 months or something like that, and then died not long after from her injuries.
Yeah.
The soldiers were like beating people, raping the women. It was fucked up.
Mm.
Burnt the commune completely to the ground. The government did an investigation on it and claimed that these 1,000 soldiers were unknown soldiers.
Right, okay. Right.
So he released a record later on called Unknown Soldier. A year later, on the first anniversary of the attack, Fela married all 27 backing singers during a stadium gig, sold-out stadium gig in Nigeria. And then, not long later, delivered a replica of his mother's coffin to the army compound where Olusegun Obasanjo lived, and just delivered this coffin and put it on the steps of his house, and then just left it there as a protest, and then wrote a song called Coffin for Head of State.
Fucking hell.
Is that what that one's about, right?
Yeah, it was basically them, because she was a national hero even if Fela hadn't existed.
Yeah.
And she was murdered by these soldiers. I've always thought that I'm amazed there hasn't already been a movie about Fela Kuti's life.
Mm.
Because you get like biopics of Johnny Cash and people like that who've had an interesting life,
but not that
most of it has been went on tour, got into drugs, fell out with a wife.
Yeah.
Whereas this is an actual fucking action movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's fucking explosions and shit, there's soldiers and stuff. It would be absolutely amazing. Obviously fucking terrifying for all of the people involved.
And you'd love the soundtrack.
And the soundtrack would be fucking brilliant. There is a musical, which has got all Fela's music in it, which is about his life story, which was like really successful on Broadway. So that has brought a lot of people that didn't necessarily know about his music before and sort of got them into it. He then, not long after that, formed his own political party called the MOP, Movement of People, because at that point it was seemingly the end to military rule. Nigeria was supposed to be going a bit more democratic.
Yeah.
I believe that my understanding of it is that that was a bit of a facade and it actually wasn't really much more democratic.
That would not be a surprise.
No. But yeah, it's so influential on so much music that I love.
Yeah.
And I just, and yeah, it's stuff that you've got to put the work in. The songs, as you guys have mentioned, are fucking long.
And it's a thing of his to have a 10-minute introduction before there's any singing.
Yeah, it's like the endless groove.
I mean, most of them songs could be cut in half for me.
There is a best of where there's like shortened versions of some of the tracks edited down, but that's fucking sacrilege, basically. He used to only because the shrine, his club, yeah. He'd play something like nearly every night there. He'd do a show. He'd come on stage at something like 2 o'clock in the morning and play till the sun came up. And that would be like one or two songs because they were way longer than the recorded versions are. And once they were recorded, he'd never play those songs again. So he'd play them up until they were recorded, and then that song's out there, so he'd move on to the next one. And he's not so well known in the UK because it's not music that we tend to hear unless you search it out.
Yeah.
But he's so influential on, I mean, the entire fucking genre of Afrobeat, which is obviously still massive worldwide, just not so much in like white Western sort of areas. But he's also influenced so many, you know, he's influenced funk, he's influenced like dance music, he's influenced post-punk, because, you know, bands like Talking Head to Certain Ratio are all definitely influenced by Fella's Groove.
Yeah.
And you know, later on, stuff like LCD Sound System is definitely taking an influence from it with their quite long grooves that go on for, you know, 12 minutes and that sort of thing. I'm guessing probably most people listening won't be that familiar, but try and check it out. It won't be for everybody, but I fucking love it. I think we're probably about done there.
Yeah.
We're talking about Kings of Leon now, then.
Yeah, Tracy
chose Kings of Leon and forgotten that she chose
it. I don't know why.
So, Tracy, tell us about Kings of Leon.
Okay.
Naked in the night and looking for some play. Just another girl.
Kings of Leon are an American rock band formed in Nashville in 1999. The band is three brothers, Caleb, Nathan and Jared Followill, and their cousin Matthew Followill. They've had seven albums from 2003 to 2016, also 12 Grammy nominations, including four wins.
That's pretty good.
Not bad at all.
Solid reputation.
They've described themselves basically as a family band, a country punk garage family band.
To be fair, three brothers and a cousin.
Yeah, you can't.
It's basically
you
a family
that,
band.
Can you?
Originally a blend of southern rock and blues, they evolved towards more of an arena rock sound. So in other words, they started out with a unique sound of their own, but eventually disappeared up their own arses into mainstream blandness.
That's mean. Like, they do definitely have their own sound still.
Yeah.
It's just now you can understand the words that Caleb is using.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, they became big. I mean, they toured with U2, and at that point, they just realised how big they could be.
Yeah.
And they went for it. And in fact, they said actually they weren't particularly chasing fame as such. They wanted respect for their music. They just wanted recognition for their music.
Yeah. But the way you've described it there, that they started out as a southern rock blues band, that was before they were famous.
Yes.
They then became a early 2000s indie rock band.
Yeah.
They were
garage rock revivalists.
Exactly. They were known as the Southern Strokes.
Yes.
And
which is a fair point.
Yeah, they sounded like an inbred Strokes.
Yeah. So Tracy's turn to do a Caleb impression next.
Yeah.
Two of us so far. They started out. They've got a fairly interesting origin story.
Yeah.
So it's not going to sound interesting.
How did you meet?
No, but how they started out playing music. It's not going to sound particularly interesting next to Fela Kuti.
Yeah.
No.
There's not many, you know, murders, explosions, war against the government.
I think next episode is the only band that's going to sound even close.
A lot of evangelist preaching.
Well, yeah, they started out as their father was a travelling preacher.
Mm, yeah. As a pastor.
And they didn't hear or listen to very much, if any, secular music until they were in their mid-teens.
Yeah.
They were, you know, I think their dad had a Tom Petty cassette in the car, but that was it. Nathan and Caleb started out as a like harmony singing religious duo.
Wow.
There's a documentary called Tallahena Sky that I watched the other night.
Yeah.
That has got some footage, and it's like VHS grade.
Yeah.
From the must be about 96, 97 ish. Of the two of them singing this song about Jesus. And then it's got, do you remember when people used to have camcorders and you could put your own like text and graphics on it and stuff? And it's got stuff like that about book Nathan and Caleb for your church.
Wow.
So they in their house when they were growing up, they weren't allowed to watch any TV at all.
Yeah.
There was a TV there, but it was not tuned in. It was only there for them to play an Atari ST, which is pretty cool. They had an Atari ST, but they weren't allowed to watch TV or secular music. Apparently one day one of them figured out how to tune the TV in, and they got to watch half an episode of Sesame Street before they were discovered.
Fucking
and then got a massive bollocking for it. But then apparently Nathan was given a copy of Surfer Rosa by the Pixies by a goth kid that they were friends with at school. And around about the same sort of time, their father was defrocked from the church.
Ooh, what for?
I think he'd had an affair.
Oh.
So the parents split up. He lost his job at the church. He basically stopped being as religious as he previously was. And they all got into rock music. But they started out with all the old like 70s rock and blues, which is why they started out with that kind of thing.
In fact, I mean, the songs on their first album is sort of channeling Christian upbringing to a certain degree.
There's a lot of gospel influence on there, definitely.
I mean, one of the songs is about a preacher using his power to take advantage of women.
Yes, Holy Roland Novocaine.
That's the one. I mean, that was based on a true story, apparently.
Yeah.
Well, their dad.
It might have been their dad, yeah. I don't think they've said it was their dad.
No, they didn't say it was that. No, I don't think it was.
They get on, I think, all right with their dad
in
the documentary. There's the documentary is framed around a big family get-together that they have every year, which was the most redneck thing I have ever seen.
Yeah.
There was one of their uncles in it who... Do you remember King of the Hill? There was that character Boomhauer where you couldn't understand anything to say.
Talks
exactly like him.
So, like the vocals on their first album?
Exactly, yeah, that is a fair point.
So, I mean, and the name, Kings of Leon, Leon is their grandfather.
He is. Their dad's middle name is Leon as well.
Right.
Can't remember his first name, but it's a bit inconsequential because they didn't name the band after.
Not the Kings of Jonathan.
Yeah, Kings of Bob. I got into them pretty much straight away. Their first EP, What I Saw, which was, there's three tracks on it. Weirdly, there's definitely three tracks on it. I checked.
Mm.
On Discogs, when I was looking it up, it had only got two tracks on there.
Oh, that is strange.
It was Red Morning Light was the lead track on there.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a garage rocky kind of thing. But the other two tracks were Wicker Chair and Tallahena Sky.
Mm.
Tallahena Sky is the secret track on Youth and Young Manhood.
I actually read a review of that first EP. It said it was the best thing they ever did, and it's where your Kings of Leon collection should start and finish.
That's a bit cruel.
Which is mean.
It's very mean.
Yeah, they're better than that.
They are.
They get a lot of hate in indie circles these days because they're perceived to have sold out.
Or, in fact, just... succeeded in becoming famous.
They have changed their sound.
Yeah, but
they
it's like
wanted
it,
to.
It evolved. It's not like a fucking
exactly. They
did evolve,
and it's not that they were. My perception of bands selling out is where they do something that they don't want to do for money.
Yeah,
And it's not that they've done something they don't want to do.
Or like they make a deliberate, calculated attempt to sell records.
No, they didn't do that. No, they have. But not in a
let's appeal to this demographic quite specifically.
Not in a Justin Bieber kind of way or something.
Hold on, guys. They did. They've been very, very open about that.
Okay.
They realised how much, like, how big a crowd they could play to. And they write their music so that it will appeal to as many people as possible, but it's what they want to do.
Yeah.
And they've been really, really open with that. There's no record company forcing them to, you know, let's remix this track and stuff like that necessarily. They are forging a path that they want to, but it is a really fucking mainstream.
But for somebody who liked them from their first album, it has lost a certain amount of the charm. That laid-back Nashville kind of feel to it, that drawl. The it's weird because, I mean, well, you say you can't understand a word he's singing. I find I don't listen to what he's singing so much as just the way he phrases and delivers his vocals.
Yeah.
And it was really, really quite unique. There was no confusing them with anybody else. That was their sound. Yeah. And I really liked that.
Like, he still
that first album
has
came
the
out.
Same accent. He just enunciates a lot more now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you can still tell it's him.
Perhaps he's got a speech therapist now.
But, you know, it has. It's just, it's a total stadium, this huge thing they've become. Yeah. And then there's Sex on Fire. And
well, that was the album where they became a stadium band. Only by the Night.
Which is a good album.
It is. I actually really like it. Sex on Fire is really, really overplayed.
But there's some really...
And covered by everybody.
Badly.
It's
because it's difficult.
It's got a really
intro is fucking difficult.
Exactly, the timing of the riff is really, really unusual.
Mm. Yeah,
and everybody just simplifies it, and it's wrong.
Yeah, because it starts off the beat comes in on like a fucking two count or something like that. So you're playing it, and then all of a sudden the beat comes in, and you're like, I'm playing it wrong, and you try and correct it, and you fuck up.
I think even on the end of something, it's a bit like that Radiohead videotape that we were talking about. Weird polyrhythms on there. It's way more complicated than it sounds.
Yeah, because like you're playing it.
I think you managed to get polyrhythms into this episode twice now.
Well, it was going to happen in the first half,
of
definitely.
Course.
Yeah, but like, yeah, if you're playing it, and then the drums come in, and you just about manage to ride that out, and then you have to sing it as well.
Yes.
You have to come in at a really counterintuitive point.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
The intro is very fucking clever. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Incidentally, Kings of Leon are my proof that horoscopes are bollocks.
Go on.
Right.
All this fucking... What's it? Astrology.
Yeah.
Is complete and utter bollocks. Because, Caleb...
Mm-hmm.
Was born on the 14th of January 1982.
Yeah.
I am not a millionaire, and so was I. So it's clearly bollocks.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
And another reason to hate Sex on Fire is Michael McIntyre has a whole fucking part of his set based on that song, Andy.
See, I don't know that because as soon as Michael McIntyre comes anywhere near the television, it goes off.
You just kill it.
Why have you found that out? Why
someone
have you watched that far?
Someone else told me.
Also, Tracy likes to research the negatives of everything.
Yeah, I review affirmed that song, Sex on Fire. Someone called it mumble rock. Lazy, boring and safe with pop radio eating it up like goats at a trough. It also sounds whiny, simplistic and inept, which is exactly not at all what you're saying.
No, it's not. The playing on there is very good.
But, he said, if songs were like food or drinks, this would be skimmed milk. I just thought that was a funny review.
To be fair, skimmed milk does sell quite a lot as well.
I tell you what, right, the worst thing about it, as a person who has covered it, is it makes people do that fucking pointy dance. Like, you bring it into the chorus and people sing along out of tune because it's actually a really fucking hard note to hit.
Yeah.
And to get to it in the same way is hard.
Yeah.
And then they all do the fucking pointy hand, like the thing that fucking Oasis fans and Weller fans do. It was someone's wedding. If it had been anything else, I'd have just been like, stop. I'm not playing this anymore if you're going to fucking do that. Because this is not why I started playing guitar. This is not why I'm in bands. I didn't want people to do that. I mean, obviously they did. You know, so, you know, Kings Leon, well done.
They
you wanted
well.
People to do the pointy cunt dance? You succeeded. I never wanted to cause anyone to do that, yeah. So I was pretty fucking sad about it.
I mean, I just loved early on when they had that cool as fuck garage sound with plenty of cowbell.
And you see, this is... Right.
Spotify doesn't want you to listen to it anymore,
no.
Does it?
No, the first album has mysteriously disappeared off Spotify.
2 days before we are recording is when it disappeared.
This is...
I mean, I own the album anyway.
Another example of... A band became better and more proficient at playing their instruments, and Tracy just wasn't fucking interested anymore.
It's true.
This
we
is,
can predict that.
Yeah, this is the only common factor. Why didn't you like him anymore? This really well-produced, catchy... There it is. The recording doesn't sound like shit. The playing doesn't sound like shit. The songs are fucking...
just a bit overblown and pompous, really.
I'd say the worst thing about Kings of Leon, for me, we went to see them. And we had limited visibility seats, and by fucking God were they limited. For like the first three quarters of the set, they'd got the curtain round the back of the stage, and you could just about see, like, you could see Caleb when he came to the front microphone, but there was a further back microphone, you couldn't fucking see him, you couldn't see the fucking screens, you couldn't see anything. And then, boom, they dropped all the curtains, and there's like loads of extra musicians on stage and stuff like that. And the last quarter of the concert was fucking amazing. But like, this is the kind of prop maneuver that you do for the first like three songs. You don't dick move it for like 15 songs and then go, voila, we've got all of this shit.
No,
like, no one does that.
And that was the most recent gig that you'd seen just before we recorded episode zero.
Wow.
I think
that's
you
when
might
you
have told
that
story
last time.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, long-time listeners will have heard that. If you've not heard it, go back and listen to our earlier episode.
I think I phrased it differently. I think my phrasing on this one was better. There's a dude out there in full leather. He's got leather trousers on, massive leather boots, and a leather jacket. And
it's not the gimp that you offended.
No, it's not. No, he wasn't wearing a leather gimp suit. Okay. He was wearing a PVC gimp suit. It might have been rubber, even.
Well, I was watching a Kings of Leon documentary, and they're being interviewed by some fawning English sap who is really trying hard to be cool but failing so badly. But they really annoyed me. Nathan was going on about...
Really?
Nathan
couldn't tell.
Nathan was going on about this time they spent €10,000 on wine because they decided to buy a bottle each from the year they were born. And he said that it was brilliant to get up the next morning and have such an expensive piss. And then there's Matthew showing off his favourite car, and then Jared showing you his sex playlist, and then a tour of their swanky tour bus. And
was sex on fire on his sex playlist?
No, I forget what. But it's just really infuriating rock star bollocks.
But that's what they want to do.
Mm. Yeah, well, if you want to do that, you want to do that. I mean, Caleb's always come... Like, in interviews that I've seen with him, he's always come across as quite a personable and all right individual. Yeah. Like, he's a... I believe the term is good old boy.
Yeah. Yes. There's a lot of fighting between the four of them, as you quite often get. It's sort of Gallagher Brothers level of fighting in that documentary.
But none of them are cunts.
But with better music.
Less Liam Gallagher.
There was
always a bonus.
One of their famous incidents. Have you heard about the incident with the pigeons?
Yeah.
Have you heard about that one, Tracy? Tracy, are you a pigeon trainer?
No.
Okay, so they played a gig at a big arena.
I think you've told this story before.
No,
not on the podcast.
It was fairly popular at the time, though.
Yeah.
It was everywhere.
Verizon Amphitheatre in St. Louis, they had to stop a gig because there were birds in the roof. There were a load of pigeons who were shitting on them throughout the gig.
Yeah. Which one's the bass player?
Oh, hence my pigeon trainer.
Is it Jared?
I don't know.
I only know Caleb.
Sorry, what? The bass player?
Yeah. You've not written that one instrument.
I have, Jared's bassist, yeah.
Because a pigeon shat in his mouth, didn't
it? Yes. And they put out a statement later on saying they tried to continue, but such was the ferocity and direction of bird excrement that they had to retreat after three songs. I just love the phrasing of that.
Yes.
The ferocity. Really angry bird poo. I've seen them live once. and it was at Reading 2007.
Yeah.
And the only thing I remember about it was there was some green lights. That is the only thing I remember about the gig.
Yeah, like it wasn't... When I saw them, it wasn't mind-blowing or anything like that. They were good.
I've seen an acoustic set from a Tamworth Kings of Leon covers band.
No.
What are they called?
I can't remember.
Kings of Peel. If it's not, that's what it should be. Who's in that? Do I know anyone?
It should be Leon from You Don't.
I don't know them.
Should be.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because he looks like they used to look.
Yeah. Talking to Lisa a while ago, who was convinced that their beards contain their power. And when they shave their beards and cut their hair off, that's when they went shit.
Yeah. I'll go with that.
It's not quite, because there was an album in between. Because basically the first three albums are fairly similar styled.
Yeah. They are.
They've all got bits where...
There was Youth and Young
Caleb's
Manhood.
Caleb's voice suddenly goes...
Yeah.
Have you got all of the names of the albums there?
I do.
Because they're like four... Is it four word names?
They're all five syllables apart from the most recent album.
Oh.
All right, so it says Youth and Young Manhood in 2003.
Youth and Young Manhood.
Aha, Shake,
Six.
Heartbreak.
Aha, Shake, Heartbreak. No. Youth and Young Manhood. Five.
Because of
not syllables, is it? Words.
It's not words.
Oh, no, it's not.
It's syllables. It is definitely. They're all five syllables.
Yeah, that's if you can't... Yeah.
Because of the times.
Aha, Shake, Heartbreak, isn't it? That's five.
Aha.
Aha, Shake,
Heartbreak.
Five, yes.
Five.
That was what Colin said. No,
I said five.
Sorry. Because of the times in 2007.
Because of the times.
Yep.
Only by the Night.
Only by the Night.
Which is the one they won Best International Album Award for.
Yep.
And then in 2010 they did Come Around Sundown.
Come Around Sundown.
And won Best International Group Award.
Mechanical Bull.
Mechanical Bull in 2013.
And then Walls.
Yeah, then Walls.
What's that about?
Yeah.
Just five letters.
There's rumours that Taylor Swift ghost wrote part of Walls as well.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
You can tell if there are any songs about, like, boys.
Caleb's... That song where Caleb's thinking about splitting
and
up
and
with
never
that
getting
bloke.
Back with them.
Yeah. I'm really angry with you, Katy Perry. We used to be so friendly. Then we fell out over that fucking overrated guitarist dude. What's his name?
Which overrated guitarist dude?
The blues guy who's got a signature
Joe
PRS.
Bonamassa?
No, no. Signature PRS.
Oh,
that looks like a
Strat. John Mayer.
Yeah.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Because he put it on both of them.
Nice turn of phrase there.
So I listened to Because of the Times last night for the first time in about
because
5 years. And, I don't know. I don't really like it anymore. Couple of good... I mean, On Call is a good song. Fans is all right, but I don't
know. Which one's Ragu on? Is that on that one?
I think it is. Yes, it is.
I used to only get one bit of On Call stuck in my head. Can you guess which bit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
Ragu's odd, actually. It's like they're trying to channel The Clash or something in it.
Well, yeah, it's sort of... reggae-ish, which is why it's got that name.
The vocal's great in it, a bit.
Yeah.
A bit.
I really like the guitar in it.
My
favourite song by them has always been Tallahassee Sky, which is the secret track on the first album, but it was on the first EP. Spotify was really weird. When I initially did the playlist, they hadn't got Tallahassee Sky on there.
Mm.
It was added last week...
Weird.
Onto the album, and then the album disappeared. So perhaps it's Tallahassee Sky is the key to the mystery.
Mm, maybe.
Perhaps it's got some kind of mystical powers.
I was quite sold on the guitarist's use of effects, actually. Mostly on Only by the Night, because, you know, it's a very effects-heavy album.
Well, the early stuff, he's basically using a bit of overdrive and a bit of reverb, but that's it.
And then they were like, look at pedals, and he was like, fucking
oh,
awesome.
That's a whammy pedal, I like that. Yeah, the opening track, which I've blanked on the name of at the moment, has got a lot of quite cool octave jumps with the whammy pedal.
And a delay on
a
it.
A delay.
Yeah.
On that album, so that's got the...
Closer. Is that Closer?
I think it might be Closer, which isn't a Nine Inch Nails.
No.
Or a Joy Division album.
Or a Joy Division album.
Neither of those things.
No. But it's the opening and closing track are both really good. Cold Desert is the last track. But
that's the song that's definitely about having an affair.
Probably, yeah.
I'm on the corner waiting for a light to come on. That's when I... Yeah, it's about having an affair. Yeah. 100%.
I do believe the...
being a backdoor man.
I think they get around a bit. we got much more to say.
Not really.
I was assuming Tracy would have a few more paragraphs of bile.
that's it, I think.
Oh, good work. Well done.
Excellent.
Quite restrained this episode.
So, next time we're on the letter L.
Yes, for the Lemonheads.
Tracy would absolutely love that.
I would.
Hold on.
Have we got... Wait. Oh.
I don't think Tracy put them on her list.
Who good.
How did you not put the Lemonheads on your list, Tracy?
Because I put Lightships and then you decided I couldn't do them because we talked about them during the Teenage Fan Club episode. Yeah. So that's why I didn't put the Lemonheads.
We'll do Lemonheads.
We'll do
Lemonheads.
Beyond the alphabet.
But not next week.
No. Next week.
Nor the week after.
Next episode. Because we're going to be talking about Liebach.
Liebach. Yes.
And LCD Sound System.
Yes.
So lots of stompy kick drums.
Lots of stompiness.
On both.
Yeah.
Brilliant. We've been Weedig Music. Thanks for listening. Bye.
And I think I only said noodling jazz bollocks once.